Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEF CON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEF CON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
Good morning again. Can everybody hear me? The guy asleep in the front row, can you hear me? You sure? You going to stay awake for this? Appreciate it. Well, before I even get into this, I just want to say I run around about 30, 35 conferences a year in the United States and in Europe, and I think Dark Tangent really deserves one hell of a round of applause for putting on I hope that next year we can get more people from quote-unquote my side of the world into here to get a better exchange of information going on, because there's more meat here than there is at a lot of the conferences that I go to on a regular basis. Now, coming here for me has been quite a trial. I've had a cold, and some people may have heard my toilet exploded in my room. I had 3 inches of water, and I was floating around, had the headache and everything, and they're trying to shovel it all through, and I'm trying to make some notes for this. So it didn't go exactly as planned. But then again, the FBI comes to my door fairly often as well from a lot of the work that I'm involved in, and so I get kind of used to this. What we're going to talk about today a little bit is called information warfare. And before we get into that, I give a lot of speeches, and I was at an IBM conference last September, and somebody from the audience said, Mr. Schwartau, what are your qualifications to speak? And I said, well, I used to be a rock and roll producer, which I was for 14 years, and I said, well, how does that qualify you to do what you do up in Washington and the carrying on the bills and everything? I said, well, when I was with rock and roll, I was dealing with namby-pamby, spoiled, self-centered, egomaniacal musicians who thought that they were God's gift to the world. That prepared me for dealing with Congress. So it's been quite a natural transition to get involved in this kind of world. But information warfare kind of requires a definition so we can get started. And the definition that I use, just to make it easy for the lay people who really don't understand what this is all about, is the use of information and information systems against other information and other information systems. And when we start looking at it all, I've come to a conclusion that, quote-unquote, you guys, you're not the problem. A lot of the feds think you're the problem. Phone companies think you're the problem. Corporate America may think you're the problem. But what we're going to get into is where the real problem is. And it's going to turn out that you guys are part of the solution, and we're going to show you how. First thing we have to realize is that the world changed very dramatically in the last few years. I think Ray's heard some of this before, and a few other people in the audience have heard me speak about this. After the Cold War, and in theory it's after the Cold War now, we're really in an economic information asset-based world, especially here in the United States. We don't have the large manufacturing facilities, the Pittsburgh steel mills and all of that driving our economy. We don't have the fences and the barbed wire and the dogs and the teenagers with M16s guarding our factories anymore. What we have is information-based society. And the world is an economic-based global economy now. And the numbers are very, very intriguing when you look at it. The economy of the United States is $6 trillion a year. The economy of the world is $26 trillion. So the United States represents, with 250 million people, with 5% of the population, represents about 25% of the gross national product of the entire world. Interesting number. However, we've got Wall Street. We've got the money exchanges. We've got the future exchanges. We've got hedges. We've got legalized gambling on the global economy to the extent of in excess of $1 quadrillion. We're leveraging our money by the extent of about 40 to 1. And we're going to find that the information warriors, the real bad guys, are going to be playing in this arena a little bit more than we might have been thinking in the past. So what we have is the distinction between the haves and the have-nots. Now, obviously, the United States is part of the haves. Western Europe, 700, 600 million people, depending upon how you look at it, they're part of the haves. But what about the other 4 billion people? The other 4 billion people, the Southern Hemisphere, China, India, South America, they're part of the have-nots. Yet, with the explosion of information availability, what happens? They get to watch Dynasty. They get to watch Married with Children. They get to see what we have. They get to realize how much they don't have. And what happens as a result? What's the natural human inclination? To want a piece of the pie. As Count de Meuron, in an excellent book called The Fourth World War, said, the Fourth World War is the battle between the haves and the have-nots. The Third World War, as Nixon said, was the Cold War. We won that, now we're on to the Fourth. And the rules are going to be very, very different. And as we get into this, I'm going to show you that it's not going to be bombs and bullets. It's not going to be tanks. It's not going to be submarines marching into San Francisco Harbor. It's going to be information systems. And we're going to look at what these guys are capable of doing, because they're coming. But here in the United States, we have some unique social phenomena occurring as well. One of them is what I call binary schizophrenia. You like that? Would you care to define that for me, sir? Binary schizophrenia. Let's take an example. You walk up to the hotel desk. You walk up to your bank teller. You go up to the ATM machine, maybe the airport. You stick in the card. You're waiting for a response based upon something in the computer. And it takes longer than 3 seconds or 5 seconds. And you wonder, what's wrong? And the majority of America worries a lot more than you do. You understand the technology. But when people walk up to the technology that they do not understand, they cease to trust it. And the schizophrenic aspect is, I need computers. Without the computers, our society could not function as it is functioning today. We wouldn't have everything that we have. Yet at the same time, the majority of Americans don't understand it. And the information warriors are going to use that as an exploitive tool. Terrorist, maybe. But when you can spread distrust, when you can sow worry by exploitation of something that they do not understand, it is in a very, very effective weapon system, and we're going to show how that's being used. We also have digital addiction. And I think a number of people in this room are very familiar with that term. There's a group of hackers in England that actually got off. They got off. You may have heard about it. The jury said, not guilty. They're addicted to computers. No crime committed. Then we have information overload. I think we're all subject to that. I've talked to a number of people who've wanted to cut their own net connections, sever their fingers, because there's just too much information out there, and we do not have the means. We don't have the culture. We don't have the ethos, and we certainly don't have the technology yet to automatically filter down 95% of the crap that's out there in order to give us what we really want. And we have all these things affecting us. Plus, we have universal empowerment. A lot of people have talked about technological empowerment. We've got it. We have 125 million conventional kind of computers out there. And we have another between 2 and 3 billion computers out there running microwaves and VCRs and television sets and cell phones and every other device that is somehow microprocessor controlled. And the majority of the people out there do not really understand it. I keep hearing the phrase, they don't have a clue. They're assholes. They just don't know what it's all about. They're not going to get it. They're losers. Well, maybe they are. Maybe they're not. At one point or another, they're going to have to start getting a clue, because as the information wars start, they're going to be direct victims of it. Now, there's something that we as a country have to keep in mind here. Since the end of World War II, when we were still an industrial country, we based the defensive policy of the United States upon a very single premise. And that was, we based our defense policy upon our adversaries' capabilities, not their presumed intentions. What that means is, if in those days the Soviets built a bigger bomb, we had to have 2 bombs. If then they made 3, then we made 4. And this is what turned into the mutual assured destruction strategies of the 1960s. But it worked. Right or wrong, somehow we came out of it. And we based it upon their capabilities. And most of the people in this room know that your capabilities exceed the defensive postures of corporate America, the government computer systems, and certainly the personal ability of most Americans to be able to defend themselves against various types of information warfare. And as we march forward in the information age towards the end of this decade, we as a country are going to have to start modifying our posture and developing, as I get it, we'll get into, a real policy. What are we trying to do? Where are we going, and how are we going to handle it? So first of all, let's get into what some of these information weapons are. I'm not going to waste a lot of time on the things that you're real familiar with. Malicious code, you're all very familiar with what malicious code can do. You know a lot better than I do what it can do, and you can program it a lot better. Viruses, we've talked about viruses. Padgett did an excellent job. What people did not discuss was what a rich guy might be able to do with viruses or Trojan horses. A real bad guy, not somebody who's just out there screwing around, having some fun with Michelangelo or some Bulgarians with a hard-on for the U.S. or what have you. A real bad guy. What could a real bad guy do with some viruses? Could he go out and buy a software company? Could he go out there and build a shareware company? And distribute beautiful, well-working, well-accepted, heavily documented, updated software over a period of years, build a customer, get customer base, gain acceptance. But the malicious code, the whatever his motivation may be, the detonation is not designed to go off for 3 or 4 years. What if Bill Gates built into Windows 3.1 a virus because he said, I'm dying of cancer, the planet can go with me? Again, the capability is there, not the presumed intentions. And this is something we have to keep in mind when we look at the capabilities of the information weapons that are out there. You guys know about sniffing the net. You guys, there's a number of people out there sniffing the net far more than anybody really wants them to be sniffing the net. You guys know how to do it. The bad guys know how to do it, too. Sniffing the switch, playing with the ESSs, with the cell links. You know how it's done. But the motivation between what hackers and freakers do and what real information warriors might do with the same capabilities is the distinction that we need to keep in mind throughout the rest of this decade. Chipping. Chipping is a phenomena that a lot of people just don't understand. You guys have an understanding with the chipping of phones, changing the EEPROMs in them with various types of calls, trying to make new IDs, getting free stuff out of it. But what if, again, the bad guys had some money and some real motivation? Could they? Could they go to a silicon foundry somewhere down in Taiwan, Singapore, Far East, where cash speaks very loudly, and they say, hey, build me this chip, just like this beautiful little Hitachi chip. Label it Hitachi, but I have a few little extra circuits in it. What is the difference between a Trojan horse and software and a Trojan horse and hardware? Could Maytag dryers all of a sudden all overload on Super Bowl Sunday? The capability is there. The military relies upon integrated circuits for the proper operation of its entire defense infrastructure. Yet they do not have the ability, nor do they attempt to, test every single chip that comes through it and look for what may be hidden inside of it. The technology just doesn't exist. The capability for the bad guy to exploit that vulnerability certainly does exist. And from the military standpoint, one would think, hey, we better take a look at something like this and figure out what can we do. But at this point, they haven't. So chipping is another one of the information weapons that could be used. Now, last evening, I spoke about VanEck radiation, electromagnetic reception off of CRTs and computers. I'm not going to go through that again. But with enough money, the motivated guy, he'll be able to get you. He'll be able to find out exactly what's going on. What if lawyers all of a sudden knew that their adversaries' briefs, their opening statements, knew everything about the opposition's case, were available? Why would it be available? Because it's all processed on computers inside of law firms. Law firms, do they have security? Any form of security? Any concept of security? No, of course not. What an ideal way to passively and insidiously and invisibly penetrate your adversary and be absolutely assured of getting away with it. It's ideal. And it's being done. Major chemical company up in the San Francisco area has been under attack by the Japanese using this technique for several years. Chemical Bank in New York was targeted. Their credit card center on 43rd Street and 6th Avenue targeted. The New York State Criminal Law, the computer police got involved with it. Chemical Bank said, nah, we're not going to bother at all. Down in Houston, a series of tests were done with a major bank in order to test against what could be done against an ATM machine. Can I get ATM information off of the ATM machine? Sure you can. Absolutely, using the same techniques. Good movie, if you haven't seen it, called Prime Risk, outlines the same principles in use. It's maybe Keenan Wynn needed to pay his mortgage that month, but watch the movie. It'll give you a good idea of what the technology is capable of doing with the right amount of motivation behind it. I'm not going to get into that one that much. But then the technology that I know a lot of you want to hear about is called Herf Guns and Empty Bombs, the nuclear weapons of the information age. And these are real. These are real. Before I tell you what they are, let me tell you what I told Congress. I was testifying before Senator Congressman Glickman and Valentine's committee. They're the ones who wrote the Computer Security Act of 1987, which is a wonderful bill. And I described to them how electromagnetic weapon systems, Herf guns and empty bombs, could actually shut down entire portions of the economy, shut down telecommunications, how they could shut down portions of the Federal Reserve System and Wall Street. And after a couple seconds, Mr. Glickman said to me, he says, Mr. Schwartow, I understand that these Herf guns, they're mighty dangerous things. And I said, yes, sir, they are. And he said, do you think we should add them to the Brady Bill? Go Congress. Herf guns and empty bombs are a very simple principle. Just like we talked about the Van Eck radiation, if you have an electrical device, it radiates. Simple electronics 101. But at the same time, we can cause interference. If you have a cell phone and you want to do some overloading of a cellular conversation and jam it, we did it back in the 70s with CBs, just put a high-watt linear on it, and you'll shut down every CB nearby. Cellular phones, the same thing. But with computers and networks, the exact same phenomenon exists. Introduce enough electromagnetic radiation into the circuits of the networks, of the ICs at the front ends, of the transponders of communication systems, even of satellites. We heard about the satellite hackings from back in the mid-80s. Introduce enough electromagnetic current or voltage fields around your target, and one of two things will occur. Either the systems will merely crash, shut down, require a reboot, which would be considered pure harassment. Or if your field is loud enough and strong enough, you can actually cause not only the systems to shut down, but you will cause the erasure of the disks, erasure of the tapes, erasure of the hard disks, and the fusing of the silicon barriers inside of the integrated circuits themselves. These are real. These are real devices. The first one I saw over in Europe. Backpack size. Cost about $100, $150 to build. Put out 16 megawatt of pulse. Now, if you don't know what 16 megawatts is, inside of your computer, you're running on the milliwatts. You're running 1 billion times less power. So 16 megawatts is certainly capable of having a dramatic effect. Now, the SDI program, the military has been involved and has been working on this research for a number of years, Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore. If you're interested in the technology, the only book that I found that is open source is called High Power Microwaves. I don't know if anybody's interested in it, I'll show it to you. It's also referenced in the back of my book, Information Warfare, available at Walden Books and Dalton. How to get that plug in there, please. Now, the problem with Herf guns and empty bombs is they are theoretically called non-lethal weapons. I gave a speech a while back in front of 500 spook spies and goblins in Washington from all of the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, the MOUSE, all of the groups up there in Washington. And I kind of talked briefly about some of the technologies that I viewed as being a danger in the future. And after my speech, a number of them came up to me and started asking me more and more in-depth questions. And I said, wait a minute, hold on. You guys are supposed to be the experts. What is this? I'm working with open source material, figuring some stuff out. You have all the classified stuff. Why are you so interested in my work? And the answer staggered me. I was not prepared for it. It was a simple one. They're not allowed to talk to each other. So nobody really knows. Inside the classified circles, the guy that knows viruses can't talk to the guy that knows Tempest, can't talk to the guy that knows electromagnetic energy, can't talk to the guy that knows chipping. can't at all. And I found that very, very alarming. But on the Herf gun issue, the interest has always been very, very high, especially since the Defense Department has actually deployed these weapon systems. Is anybody aware of that yet? Anybody aware of it? At the end of the Iraqi War, General Schwarzkopf said, what we need is the equivalent of a nuclear bomb to go over a third world country and shut down its entire infrastructure using this technology. Well, in fact, we did that at the beginning of the Iraqi War, in the opening seconds. But the government, in its infinite wisdom, put out a disinformation or misinformation campaign that I call the Iraqi virus hoax. Is anybody familiar with the Iraqi virus hoax? Okay, a couple people, good. The story went like this. On January 10th, 1992, Ted Koppel, 11:30 at night on Nightline, my wife and I were watching, and he proceeds to say how a computer virus won us the war. I looked at my wife and said, something's wrong with it. I better listen. And the story went, the NSA designed this whiz-bang virus and had it inserted into a little chip. The CIA took this integrated circuit and flew it by courier over to France. They took it into a French printer company, put the chip inside the printer, reboxed it up, and made sure that it was headed to Iraq. So they fly the printer over to Amman, Jordan, because that's as close as anybody could ship over there with the embargo at the time. And they truck the printer into Iraq. The printer then goes down to one of the forward-deployed air defense radar systems on the borders of Kuwait, which is supposed to defend the Iraqi airspace and land space against invasion. So this printer is sitting there. And moments before the cruise missiles are coming in, this virus jumps from the printer into the air defense radar systems, which are Windows-based, and shuts them all down. This was the story that Nightline and U.S. News and World put out. Something bothered me. Something bothered me. So I spent the rest of that evening going through my highly organized files, and I found it. I found it. There was an article in InfoWorld from April 1st, 1991. Point for point, issue for issue, name for name. Somebody had somebody fooled. But it turns out that the Air Force generals who gave the story to U.S. News and World Report, Brian Duffy is the reporter, they stood by the story, and U.S. News and World Report stood by the story. And the Washington School of Journalism report last October trashed my butt for taking them on, even though I was right. Because what really happened is they were using empty bombs. They were using magnetic weapon systems that they were trying to cover up. And what really happened was the Navy deployed right before, remember watching this on TV, the cruise missiles going down the streets of Baghdad making right turns at the Al Rashid Hotel. Everybody remember that? Right before those went down, we set off a lobby of about four non-nuclear-tipped magnetic bombs, Tomahawk missiles, that in fact did land and explode magnetically right near the air defense station. So what happens? Inside these concrete bunkers with all the defense terminals and the radar systems and everything else, the lights go off, communication goes away, the CRTs go down, the power supplies are out, and you end up with 300 Iraqis searching for a power switch, which is never going to work. And that's how we actually bought the extra minute and a half in order to get into Baghdad unnoticed. So it's all part, again, of information warfare. We wanted to shut down their information systems, and our government wanted to feed us disinformation to cover up what we were actually doing, all in the name, obviously, of national defense. But now that it's all open information, they still stuck by this story for some unknown reason. Maybe Ray will be able to tell me one day in his infinite wisdom why. But information warfare is much more than just the military aspects. I break information warfare down into three broad categories, and they're very smart categories, class 1, 2, and 3. Class 1 information warfare is what I call personal information warfare. And there's two statements I don't think anybody in this room would really disagree with. Number one, there's no such thing as electronic privacy. Would everybody pretty much agree with that? Okay. The second statement that I love to use when I do radio and TV shows, it really blows their skirts up. In cyberspace, you are guilty until proven innocent. Yep. I got one yup. Out of 200 people, I get one yup. Two yups. Excuse me. Most Americans do not have a clue that when a judgment is made about them, about their credit rating, their medical history, whether they're good enough to rent a house, whether they're good enough to buy a car, that the decisions that are made about them are made based upon the contents of approximately 50,000 different national information-based computers over which they have little or no control. Most of the databases, I don't know what they all are. I don't think you guys know what they all are, but there's thousands and thousands of them out there to find out all these little private secrets. But in cyberspace, you're guilty until proven innocent, and we have to make a decision in the not-too-distant future. Is that the way that we want America to be? And we're going to have to ask some questions. Class II information warfare is more generally known as industrial espionage, economic espionage. We keep hearing about it a great deal. But again, we really don't know how much is going on, because the companies that get hit tend to cover it up a great deal. For people that are professional security in the security business, you know that customers say, shh, shh, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody. It's embarrassing. For network providers that get hit, shh, shh, don't tell anybody. Industrial espionage that we know of is up 400% in the last 6 years. 400%. And it's currently costing the United States economy an estimated $100 billion. Well, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, except if you go down to the U.S. Department of Commerce figures, $100 billion translates into 3 million jobs. And all of a sudden, we're talking about people again. We're talking about national economic security. I got visited by the FBI the other day. I work out of my home, and my wife left me with my 3-year-old boy, so he was sitting there doing something in Excel. I don't know what he was doing. I had 3 lines going on the phone, and the door rang. And nobody ever rings my door in the middle of the day unless it's somebody to play with my kids. So I go to the door, and I say, who are you? He goes, FBI. I go, wait a second! I figured I just gave him away. So I had to take care of the kids, take care of the phones, get everything set up. He came in. I had just given him a TV show in Seattle. And I accused Boeing Aircraft of being the victim of industrial espionage on the 777 project and having all of the designs throughout its development history being sent over to Paris. And I documented step by step how it was done with IBM right in the middle of the chain. Step by step documentation. And the FBI got a little worried about it. Wonder why. A little late. A little late. But this is going on all of the time. And what we have determined is the current U.S. policies actually encourage industrial espionage against this country. They encourage it. Now, how can I say that? Let's go back to 1981. One of the most famous cases of industrial espionage was Hitachi against IBM. And IBM was introducing the new, I think it was the 3090 disk drives. Ray, is that about the... 3090. Who's IBM expert out here? Is it the 3090? All right, it was the 3090. And they had this for their mainframes and all the big stuff. And Hitachi wanted to have a piece of the IBM peripheral market. So what they did is they sent out their corporate spies to Silicon Valley and up to upstate New York, where the Adirondack Papers, which are the annual papers that IBM builds every year for their strategic policies and where they're going, Hitachi wanted them. So Hitachi invested several millions of dollars in various types of industrial spies in order to access this information. What's it going to be worth to Hitachi? Oh, perhaps $2 to $3 billion in sales over a period of 3 to 4 years during the lifetime of that particular product. So they went out, they stole this information, they got the information that they needed. The FBI got involved, there was a sting operation. And a few people got arrested. They were fined $10,000. Does that or does that not suggest that we're encouraging industrial espionage? When it is cheaper for our economic and technological adversaries to come in and steal from us than it is for them to go develop their own. Is that the policy that we should have? Is that the way that we want to move into the future? Not in my way of thinking, not at all. The third type of information warfare is what I call Class 3 information warfare. Thankfully, it hasn't hit yet. Class 3 information warfare is where a dedicated, motivated, and well-financed adversary, say the United States, decides to build an arsenal of some of the weapon systems that we've talked about, some of the ones that you know about, an en masse attack. The question is, what sort of damage could he do? Could this group do? If they plan it a year, 2 years, 3 years in advance with the technologies that are openly available, non-military technologies, what could they do? Well, if the goal is to affect the economy of the United States, because nobody's going to be bringing planes over New York, we know that, where would they attack? Well, in our scenarios, Wall Street, Culpeper. Culpeper is in the Federal Reserve Board headquarters outside of Washington, D.C. Excuse me?
And Swift?
Swift is right across the street. I was there a few weeks ago. And there's no protection at Swift whatsoever. We'd also go after the telecommunication systems. In the United States, there are 18 major PowerPoint switches, huge transformers, 18 of them. We have two spares. Guess where they're made? Germany. Lead time, 18 months. So we'd go after the power grid. And we'd also go after transportation. If using the types of technologies that I've talked about, the things that you know about, and I had an army of a couple hundred well-paid, motivated guys who, if they screw up, I kill them because I'm merciless. Could I have a severe effect on the economy of the United States? And the answer is obviously yes. This has not happened yet. And people in Washington occasionally say to me, there's nobody out there that's going to do it. And I say in response, that's right, everybody in the world loves Americans today. So I guess I don't have to suggest the narco-terrorists, some of the religious fanatics, perhaps some of the green groups that are just getting a little frustrated. There's enough people out there that might be able to launch something like this. The technology is part of the proliferation. It's part of the empowerment of the planet. And it's incumbent upon us to realize, again, the capabilities in distinction to the intentions. Now, instead of just bitching about all this, in the book Information Warfare, and all the books of Dalton, I introduce what I call a national information policy. Here we are, building a national information infrastructure, kind of like the movie with Kevin Costner, The Field of Dreams. If we build it, they'll come. But we don't have a policy. We don't know what the hell we're doing. Certainly Washington doesn't. During the industrial age, we had an industrial policy to defend ourselves, to understand our position in the world, how important the industrial growth of the United States was for the growth of our economy, for the sustenance of our people, and for our position in the world. But in the information age, we've neglected to do that. We don't have one. We talk about, in the book and in Washington, an electronic bill of rights, which I think is desperately, desperately needed because we're losing every bit of rights that we've got. And we need a constitution for cyberspace, because right now the people that are out there calling the shots do not understand it at all. It has to be a very high-level policy. We don't have to get down to the bits and bytes. Let's step back for a moment 200 years. 200 years ago, 54 men marched into Philadelphia and said, we have a task ahead of us. The war with England is over. We have 13 disparate groups, the colonies, that need to find a way to fuse themselves together into a cooperative of some sort to become viable on the global scale. In order to find a way to populate the land west of the Appalachians, in order to find a means to have an effective commerce. Do those words sound familiar to what we're going through today? The war's over. We're moving into cyberspace. but there are no rules. There's no guidelines. And we're suggesting that there need to be some guidelines, not so much from the personal standpoint and the anarchistic attitudes of some of the kids and maybe some of the people out here, but from the national level, because that's ultimately what's at stake. We have the opportunity today to define the future instead of being consumed by it if we allow total anarchy and Washington current thinking to proliferate and continue. We're going to be in some big trouble. So there's some questions that we really need to have answered. And if anybody's got answers to some of these questions, I'll be very happy to listen to them. Number one, what is information? I gave a speech in front of some lawyers, 100, 110 lawyers a while back. I said, what is information? I got 392 different answers from 110 lawyers. Who owns information? Do you own your own name? Or is American Express and Visa and Procter & Gamble out there selling your name? Well, we know they're doing that. Is that right? Is that what it should be? It's the way it is right now. Unless we decide to do something about it, it's the way it's going to continue and only going to get worse. There is no legal status of information in the current system. If you look at some of the cyber crimes and cyber laws that have attempted to be implemented over the last 7 or 8 years, almost 50% of the convictions that are enforced in lower courts are overturned on appeal because an awful lot of the laws that are trying to be enacted came back from the 30s based upon J. Edgar Hoover's interstate commerce trafficking laws for going after Dillinger and vehicles. They don't apply. They do not apply. Justice Department knows this. The Justice Department also has other concerns and can't come along on board with something that is, in their view, this radical in order to define a future. They have some real problems with this. What are we going to do with active versus passive publishing? I don't see too many distinctions made about this on the net. And this gets very important, especially when we talk about information contraband. There's certain types of contraband out there, all right? In Denmark, child pornography is blatantly legal. Here in the United States, child pornography is blatantly illegal, despite your particular proclivities. Now, without arguing the debate of whether child pornography is right or not, if I have a service and somebody downloads child pornography to me, they have actively published that information to me, should I, as a passive receiver of that information, be liable for some violation of some statute? Or should only the person who actively publishes the information, in distinction to passively publishes it, have a responsibility for adherence to the laws? We don't have the answers. We do not have the legal construct to put these paradigms together yet. What about information evaluation? How much is information worth? Information has the very unique property of both being entropic and anti-entropic at the same time. It's entropic in that over time, a lot of information ceases to have any value. It may be of value for 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 days or some short period of time. But then other information is anti-entropic in that the idea before its time. Sit on it. We'll wait on it. The patent's not quite ready. People aren't ready. But when it is, it's going to be worth a fortune. But how do we evaluate this information? When we look at the companies on Wall Street, J.P. Morgan's or Salomon Brothers or 3M or any of the companies that are building technology based upon information, how do they base the value of that? Now, I've spoken to the lawyers, I've spoken to the CFOs, all these characters, and I ask them the same question. And they kind of stutter with their thumb periodically anatomically displaced. And I asked them, I said, how come you're an information company? The FBI says it's an information company. Trucking companies now say they're information companies. So what's the information worth? Has anybody ever seen an annual report, a stockholder's report, that has a line item that says information assets? Their entire company's value is in their information, yet they don't have a clue how to measure it. There's a lot of economists out there that are saying that they certainly do need to have a new means of evaluation if we are going to maintain a leadership role in an information-based economy, especially a $1 quadrillion global economy. But we don't have the means to do it today. Can we define cyber borders? There are arguments to say yes, there are arguments to say no. Currently today, if I do a telephone crime and I steal some money electronically out of some computers, if I do it in my home state between where I live near the Tampa area over to Miami and I do it over the phone line, it's obviously a Florida crime. If, however, the FBI discovers, or FDLE discovers, that the phone line connection between me and Miami went through Georgia, all of a sudden it's a federal crime. Does that make sense? We need to make some decisions about what really makes sense with the concept of cyber borders. Can we, as a country, defend our cyber borders? Do we have that capability? Do we have the political will? For example, if Gaddafi came in and bombed the Statue of Liberty, would we have a response? Hell yeah. We'd bomb the living hell out of him and get his other kids. But when France comes in, or Korea, or Israel, or Germany, Taiwan, when we have state-sponsored industrial espionage that comes in and takes away people's jobs and the economic assets of the United States, we do not have a policy. We do not have a means of a response. That's a starry state of affairs, and that's the state we're in right now. Ultimately, we just have a very, very few questions that we have to ask ourselves and ultimately have answered. Do we want to lead the world in the information age? Real simple question. That's a yes or a no answer. Washington doesn't know the answer. Do we, as citizens, want to reclaim our privacy and our rights? Do the original tenets of the Constitution from 200 years ago and the concept of public records, do they apply anymore? 200 years ago, the concept of a public record meant I got on my horse, rode down an elm tree covered dirt lane to the little wooden courthouse to find out who bought the back 40. And it made sense. But today, you all know what we can do with public records. Is that right? Is that what we want? We have to make some decisions, and we have to help Washington get exactly what we as citizens do want. Can we define our future? Should we define our future? Or should we just let the anarchy reign? These are the kind of questions that we really have to ask ourselves. For us, for other Americans who really don't understand and who won't understand for years and perhaps decades to come, for corporate America, who unfortunately is battling us all every inch of the way with this, trying to hide behind its security through obscurity and the refusal to admit that something's wrong, and Washington, well, they're a lost cause by and large. You guys have a hell of an opportunity. You guys understand it. You really do. That's why I said earlier, you're not part of the problem, you're part of the solution. Part of the solution, yeah, there's some hanky-panky and there's some nasty stuff going on here and there, that's fine. That's not the real problem. Maybe in years hence, we'll look back and say, hey, if it weren't for the hackers, hey, we'd never have been warned. There's an argument either way on that. I mean, I kind of favor it because I think that you guys have shown what is capable of being done. I know some of you are aware of the professional hacking that is going on out of Korea now, out of Taiwan. The Germans have had it going professionally since 1988 with groups of a couple hundred hackers coming after us. And they're not leaving any tracks. These guys are pros. Is this what we want? You guys can get involved. You can actually do something. Help us accomplish something. In the 1990 movie Flashback, for those of you that have seen it, it ended with a captured 60 radical activist hippie, Dennis Hopper. He plays a great role. And he was forewarning FBI agent played by Kiefer Sutherland. He says, kid, the 90s are going to make the 60s look like the 50s. Why don't we all see what we can do about that? You guys have been a great audience. Thank you very much. Any questions? I saw his hand first. Yes, sir.
Talked about the haves and have-nots initially, and And it seems your goal is to, in fact, continue to protect from the heaven, not like it's a heaven. And it seems to me that the whole point of cyberspace is that it points out, and your talk about the dangers of electronic warfare point out that the problem is not electronic warfare. The problem is that the notion of nation is in a fairly archaic notion in the modern electronic age. Cyberspace doesn't have room for this structure of nations, in my opinion.
I think what I'm saying, I don't think I'm trying to say, hey, let's keep the have-nots in a have-not world. What I'm saying is, let's pick a set of rules. Let's know what we're doing instead of not knowing what we're doing. I don't have all the answers. I have opinions. You have opinions. Other people will have their opinions. I don't know what the right answer is, ultimately. I really don't. I mean, if I did and I proclaimed that, I'd be more arrogant than I already am. I'd like us to set up a set of rules. And that's why I talk about a constitution for cyberspace. What the social ethos of giving to the have-nots and all of that, that's really a separate question in distinction to us being able to protect ourselves from what we already know to be an adversarial condition. That's all. I don't know what the answers are.
But the term us and them, is that not an archaic notion in cyberspace?
In cyberspace it may be, but in Rwanda it's not. It's a matter of what it's from your standpoint. All right, global cyberspace. I agree with you. What information should be available to everybody is your choice. What you own, you control, or what you think you own and you control should be your choice of who gets it. It should not be somebody else's choice to make for you. That's my only point. The lady in the back who. I understand. I heard this from John Markoff. I assume that you're referring to a posting on the Well account from W. Schwartz that said something about Lenny being a schmuck. I don't have a Well account. So my opinion of their security, do I need say it? Any other questions? Okay, great. Let's go eat. Thanks.